Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, where...
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Sielkowski.
We are your storytelling hosts today, Monday, July 13th. Whoa, the month is almost half over. Our theme today is Grumps and Curmudgeons. And I'll let our listeners think a while about what stories we might be preparing. How are you, Stosh? My favorite curmudgeon.
Thank you. Wow. I've never been called a curmudgeon before.
That's never?
Good. I don't think so. Or I might
not
be
in your
part
theory.
Of my selective memory, you know?
Okay.
I tend to try to forget negative things, but I don't know. Curmudgeon isn't to me as a bad thing.
No.
You know,
necessary.
Yeah, Anyway, I'm fine, and I'm. I had past couple of days have been really nice. Not doing anything special, but Terry and I took a lovely drive yesterday to Greenbrier State Park, and It was just wonderful. Terry posted a picture and I posted a picture. We went to the park and it was quite a line to get in, line of cars. And the woman who was directing traffic, you know, told us it cost $10 it would be $5 a piece to get in. But she said, you know, if you'd like to get a Golden Age card, you know, it's $10 a piece, but they're good for every place in the state of Maryland. You get in for free. So, wow. So we went into this other line, and Terry walked down to the booth and paid, and we got, you know, the line moved at a good enough pace so that by the time Terry had paid and got our Golden Age cards, she was able to get in the car, and I pulled right in and back in line, and we were through. We found this lovely place where we could sit under a shady tree, and we could see the lake off in the distance and the swimming area, which was absolutely mobbed. And the number of cars parked in the various parking lots astounded me, because this was 9:15 in the morning, and we only stayed there about, oh, I guess an hour and a half. When we left, they were closed, no more, couldn't let in anybody else. There were hundreds of cars, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. But we set up our chairs, we got our coffee. And right to our right, on a nice field, were some Hispanic people playing soccer, a group of men and women, girls and boys. And that was at the far end of this field. And right near us, like 25, 30 feet away, were five Hispanic men, young men, probably in their 20s, playing soccer. And they had game. They were making up rotation games, and it was delightful. It was wonderful, you know, to watch a sporting event. And they were having so much fun, and they were all very skilled, which was, you know, and they weren't all athletic looking. You know, a couple of the men were on the heavy side. But boy, it was so much fun watching them. They were having so much fun, and we were having so much fun being able to watch. And After about an hour, when they were leaving, I thanked them. I said, that was great. I said, I love football, and that was wonderful to see, you know. And they said, ah, gracias. And, you know, it was just delightful. But we had no desire to go down to the swimming area because there were just far too many people. Anyway, it was just a very nice way to begin the Sunday.
Did you get to walk around the lake, or?
No, we were just there to sit and have our coffee.
Very nice, a quiet morning.
I'm at my tender age, I could care less about taking a walk around a beautiful place. I mean, I do. I like to walk in that, but really, especially in the morning, I love to sit with a cup of coffee on the front porch and see what the world is doing. That's one of my favorite activities.
Well, I'm glad you got to do that.
Yeah. And we'll do it again because now we have that golden age pass.
You can go everywhere in the state.
And we got a map and everything. There's so many state parks.
Beautiful parks, yes.
Yeah, so.
And we are talking about Maryland because even though we're broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, you and I both live in Maryland.
Yeah, oh boy. And I got this morning, I sat down, picked up my phone, and I got a message from a young woman who, well, I'm not sure how young she would be now, but she said, it's been 36 years since I last saw you, and then went on to tell me who she was and the boy she dated on my track team. And as soon as she told me who her boyfriend was, the wonderful golden memory ball opened up because Patty and Timmy were an adorable couple. He was handsome. She was very pretty. She still is. And they often were in my room, and they were just delightful teenage sweethearts. You know, they would sometimes come in my room and bicker about things and everything, but they were just so much in love. And I guess it was their senior year when they broke up. But when they did, it bothered me more than it bothered them, I think. Because I liked both of them so much. She was a good student, and she was adorable and friendly. And Timmy was one of my best athletes and a real good kid. So, but anyway, she's married and she has two children, 25 and 21. And
wow.
Anyway.
So what precipitated her contact with you?
I think she saw something on Facebook or, you know, something like that and said, oops, there's Mr. Z.
Okay.
And I have had so many that my former students contact me that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they see something that maybe somebody I'm on Facebook with is a friend. Just recently, one of my college classmates contacted me. He lives in Shepherdstown. We haven't seen each other since graduation in 1966.
That's amazing.
Turns out that we have a number of friends in common.
And
in
you're almost neighbors, yeah.
Yeah, so as soon as the plague is over here, we're going to get together.
Okay, so tell us about Speak tomorrow night.
Speaking of
Shepherdstown.
Right. July 14th at 7:30, Mr. Tom Lee from Connecticut. And he's going to do some traditional stories. And I'm looking forward to it because I have never heard him. And he often speaks at the Metropolitan Opera Education Conference at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And it's Adam Booth assured our committee that this guy is wonderful. So I take Adam's word, and things are changing a bit with Speak. That things I can't discuss because they're in the works, but there's going to be some changes, not to our programming, but some changes that'll make it easier for us to hire the best storytellers throughout the world.
Very good.
We can't get people from Europe traveling here because of the university, some kind of technical rules or something. They need to be United States citizens. Since we're connected to the university some way, but that connection is about to change. We still will be connected with the university, and it'll still be a program at the university. However, we will be we'll be our own thing, mm-hmm. Run by Adam, and so lots of interesting things are in the works.
Very good.
And the month after that in August is Adam Booth. And I'll be the MC for that month.
Okay.
So that'll be exciting because I am, in my own mind, I am famous for being the shortest talk MC in the universe. I don't believe in blathering before a program. So,
well, with that note, we should probably tell a story.
Yeah, especially since we're 11 minutes in.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So, okay. So are you ready?
Yeah, but you just made me think of something as you were ending your update about Speak, and now I can't remember what it was I wanted to say, but hopefully I will remember it in the future. Yeah. Oh, that is, I'm getting little flashes on my computer saying I have an unstable connection, so I may need to pick up my story in the middle if I don't come back.
Unstable connection?
Yes.
Wow.
Internet connection. All right.
You need to get a new provider.
There's not a lot of options here. But
okay.
So, are you going to tell two stories?
Well, it depends. You know how time goes.
That's true.
I have a number of stories.
Okay. Well, do you want to start with a short one, and then I'll tell one?
Okay. I will. And when we discussed the topic, I was grouches and curmudgeons.
Grumps and curmudgeons
are a little bit nicer than what I had been thinking of.
Really?
I was thinking of people who are actually almost mean, and turn out
same
not
category.
To be quite as mean. Yeah, same thing. Okay, so. When I went to college in Maryland, I got into college in the easy way. My uncle was a priest, took me to a Catholic college. We went in, he talked to the president. At first they weren't going to let me in, but he had been in the seminary with the president of the college years before. And all I had to do was assure the president that I would be a good boy and behave myself. Of course, I was in my uniform. I had just gotten out of the army, and Uncle Joe, my uncle, was a priest, was really good with politics. So I said, I don't have to wear a uniform anymore. I'm out of the army. He said, no, I would just wear the uniform. You look so good in the uniform. Always. Anyway, it worked. So, and I studied. I decided to study chemistry. That's a whole nother story, but. As a sophomore, as soon as I got to the campus, we were there early for playing soccer, I met one of the legendary priests and teachers, a man who had worked for DuPont before becoming a priest, and who had created some products, chemical things, for DuPont, and never wanted any kind of, you know, credit or money or anything like that, because he had decided he was going to leave the business of science as a chemist and researcher, and he was going to become a Catholic priest and teach. And that's what he did. Well, this man is, he passed away many years ago, but he really truly was legendary. And everyone called him Father Chi, capital G. And when he introduced himself, he would say in front of a class, "Good morning, boys. My name is Father G. And I've had that nickname for a long time. I am not sure exactly why." And then he would look, cast his eyes to the heavens, and have a wry smile on his face. And his last name was Father Gordon. But he made sure everyone knew that Father G, the G stood for you know who, the heavenly host. Anyway, and he was a brilliant teacher. During every, as a sophomore, I headed for organic chemistry, and during every one of his lectures in the lab, which were 50, I believe it was 55 minutes in those days, we counted the number of cigarettes he smoked. Smoking in classrooms was against the law there, but not for Father G. When a student asked him once, "Father, we're told that no one's allowed to smoke in the buildings." And he said, "Really? So do you want me to go outside and have my smoke and have you guys just sit here?" And he said, "No, I was thinking about the rule." And he said, "Those rules don't apply to Father G." And we counted. And in that year, my sophomore year, one class of roughly 50 minutes, he lit 17 different cigarettes. 17 cigarettes in 50 minutes. I don't know if I could have done that, even if it was on a bet and I was drinking. But he just put one cigarette when it was down to where he was going to put it out. Of course, he was behind a lecture desk with, you know, the chemical desk, this where you could do demonstrations and things. So there was a sink there. He would just get a new cigarette out, light it off the old cigarette, and throw the butt in the sink. After class, he often asked one person at random, you know, "James, Stan, Harry, would you do me a favor? Clean those butts up and throw them away." He was very funny. He was brilliant. However, he was really difficult. One of the things I remember that he was tough on was he did things his own way. Didn't matter what the college said, didn't matter, you know, anything about that. He was in charge. And so at one time he said, "The next exam will be on Thursday evening. And you can come in, and since it's classes will be over for the day, you know, if you want to bring coffee with you, you may, and or a soda or something. And during the exam, you'll be able to get up, and if you want to go outside and have a smoke, you can just go outside the lab." And one of the guys who I think, he thought he was like F. Lee Bailey or somebody, you know, the great lawyer type. And he said, "Well, Father, this class is scheduled for on Thursdays, a schedule like it is now, from 9 in the morning until 9:55. And, I don't know about the rest of these boys, but I'm used to doing things on the schedule and keeping to it. You know, I adjust my days according to the classes." And So Father G said, so you don't want to take a test in the evening? And he said, well, I'd rather not give up my evening time, you know. And he said, very well, you do not have to take the test next Thursday in the evening. You come in and you can take the test at the regular time. But the rest of the class will take the test next Thursday evening. And said, you know, to us, is that all right? And he always called us all boys, which was good. You know, I was the oldest guy in my class, so it was fun some of the boys would say to me, don't you mind him calling you that? You're a veteran and all that. I said, listen, guys, you have to learn to pick your battles. And he's not somebody I want to battle with. You know, he has a lot of control. And he did. He had any boy, it was an all-boys school, of course, any boy who wanted to go to medical school needed his recommendation. If you graduated from this particular college and you wanted to go to medical school and you had a letter from Father Gordon saying he thought you would make a fine doctor and he would say nice things, you were destined to get into that medical school because he had such a tremendous reputation because of his science work at DuPont and also over his years of teaching. He had taught many young men who became doctors, some who were now in positions of authority at medical schools. So, anyway, on Thursday morning, this boy, young man, went and took the test, and we didn't, you know. At 55 minutes at the end of the class, Father Gordon collected his paper. He wound up not passing that test or getting a very low grade, you know. That evening, he passed out the test and he said, gentlemen, you're on your honor. If you need to take a break, please do. I'll be back about, this was 7 o'clock. I'll be back somewhere around 8:30. If you're not finished by then, don't panic. I don't go to bed that early, so I'll just wait. And so we had a couple of hours to do this test. And that was great because it was really difficult. It was one of his favorite kind of questions was starting with these chemicals and give us a list of chemicals. In the fewest steps possible, produce, and we had to produce an end product, a certain chemical. We could use any laboratory equipment. And so you had to write this out. And there always were 8, 9, or 10 steps to get to the final product. And it wasn't as simple as math, you know, where the numbers never trick you. Sometimes chemicals won't go together. It seems like, oh, if I put this with this, and I'll get that. But it doesn't always work. And you have to know those things. So every one of us in the class passed that test. There were some who finished it in 45 minutes and left. And there were some who were there longer. And the only guy who got a terrible grade, and I believe he did fail it. I think at the college in those days, anybody, any youngsters, any students listening to this, pay attention to this number. In those days, when I went to college, 62 to 66, if you got a grade lower than 78 in any course, it was not called a qualifier. 78% was what you needed to get for that course to be put in the right column. Okay. And if you had too many non-qualifying courses, even though you passed everything, you couldn't get your degree. It was very difficult, you know. Most of the kids were used to either a 70 as a passing grade, or in some cases as a 60 coming from public schools. And that, so, boy, that was a thing. Anyway, as a sophomore, I began dating a young lady whose entire family, male students, went to Mount St. Mary's College. And all of them had studied under Father G. Apparently, one of those young men, who are now older, had a run-in with Father G and did something he considered wrong. So wrong that the young man's father had to come in for a consultation. And that father was on the staff of the college. He was a science professor also. And apparently it caused some bad blood. No one ever knew why. I never knew why. Even my future mother-in-law wasn't exactly sure what her brother had done. Well, Father G found out that I was dating this man's niece. And they lived, the family, she and her brothers and sisters and mother and grandmother lived in a house that belonged to the college. And they, her, the young woman's grandfather had died, and the college told her grandmother she could live there as long as she was alive. And so they were very lucky to be able to live in that house once on at the edge of the college property. Well, from the day Father G found out I was dating this girl, there was a coolness between us. At first, when I was his student, he seemed to like me very much. He admired that I had been a military man, that I had served 3 years in our country's army, and that I wanted to make something of myself. And even though I had a, he thought, a poor background as a student, which was true, that he admired that, you know, I had the guts to go to college and work hard and everything. And this coolness really bothered me. Because at first, I had no idea what I had done, you know, how I had overstepped my bounds or something. So anyway, this young lady and I, who became my first wife, we both had a terrible first semester. So much so that even though I was 22 years old, and she was, I guess she was 19. No, she was almost 20 at the time. Her mother had a sit down with us and said, "You two cannot see each other during the week." It was very easy to go to her house because it was at the edge of the campus. I could just walk. And so we were banned, just like, you know, typical youngsters who had messed up, from seeing each other during the week. And so, which was a good thing to do, because at the end of the first semester, Father G was very ill, and he was in the infirmary. The college had their own infirmary, and I stayed there over the Christmas holidays. I stayed at the college and repaired some balances. I was good with my hands, and they actually paid me to repair balances for the science department. And I received a phone message that I was to go to the infirmary, that Father G wanted to speak with me. And he was ill. He did get over the illness. But I went and saw him, and he said, "I know that you've been seeing this girl. I know that it has affected your grades. I've spoken to a couple of your teachers, and you're not doing what you should be doing in school. And I can't tell you what to do about your personal life, but I'm warning you, if you don't do something drastically, you're going to be in trouble, because you could possibly fail one of these courses. If you fail any science course, you're going to be out of the program. That was the best wake-up call I ever had in my life. And it was given to me by a man who had a reputation for being so intolerant of fools and people who would, you know, waste his time in his class and not do the work. That there were people who wound up being out of school because they didn't do well in his class and failed. And anyway, that woke me up so much that I really changed my study habits and became much better disciplined. And on my own, talked to my girlfriend and said, I don't want to take a chance on failing out of college or getting in trouble. And so it made a wonderful difference. It was, he could have just ignored that. He could never have spoken to me. And I probably would have failed at least his class because I was not doing well. But it renewed my desire to do well. And I was able to thank him at the end of the semester. And typical of Father G, he just poo-pooed it. He said, that had nothing to do with it. You're a fine student, and that stuff. And it was private when we had the conversation. So I've always been very thankful to Father G and his memory because he didn't have to do that, but he probably saved my career.
Great story. And the little window into the post-adolescent Mr. G.
You're right. Young love is terrible. I'm convinced, and I've always been convinced, that boys should go to school with boys, girls should go to school with girls. When you become old enough and you're mature enough, then you can start seeing girls and boys.
Someday, we're going to have a conversation about your perception.
What? I have evidence that it works and that it's positive.
I'm not saying that there's not a place for same-sex higher education, but what I hear is that because you believe that you would have failed as a student if you had gone to school with young women.
Oh, I'd still be in ninth grade.
That therefore it's a bad idea for everybody.
Well,
and what you get when you segregate the sexes is an inability in some areas to relate to other people as peers.
Well, you're not in school all day. Outside of school, you should have friends, boyfriends and girlfriends. All the troubles I've ever seen in school in 40 years of teaching, all the troubles I've ever seen in schools, other than, boys trying to be tough guys and stuff like that and show their manhood, were boy-girl problems.
Well, constantly. That's not true for me.
No.
Not my observation, but okay.
Well, yeah, that my theory is the only way that people can be educated. It may lie mostly in my inability to act properly, even at the age of 22, But I'm thankful that I never went to high school or to college with any girls.
I know. I've heard you say it before.
Yeah. And one of my favorite teaching posts for 6 years was a school that did not have boys and girls in the same class. I taught all the science and girls' class.
What it makes me think of, when you say that, what I hear is a personal condemnation about women for distracting you?
Oh, God, no. Absolutely no. Absolutely no. What I admit to, and I believe firmly, is male inabilities to pay attention when females are around, and female inabilities to pay attention when males are around. Same thing. It's not, you know, the girls are bad or the boys are bad. It's they're weak.
So
not
why
everyone.
Why wouldn't it be better to have an intentional plan to help?
To what?
Help young people rise above that.
That's supposed to come in the home. And it doesn't, unfortunately, in many cases. And the way the schools are, they just jam, you know.
As a society, to the point where many things that we used to. In the home.
I missed whatever you said because you were frozen. And you're still frozen. Fanny, can you hear me?
I can hear you now, but you keep going in. And
Your picture is frozen.
Unstable connection.
Yeah, okay. And you're talking to an unstable person, so what can you expect?
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to tell a story.
Good.
And we probably should go a few minutes longer than our official time to make sure that.
So you can edit out my.
Not your, my dead air space.
Oh.
As long as you were talking, great. But if there are long periods of silence, I probably should. Okay. On the theme of grumps and curmudgeons, that is what we said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And before I start that story, I do want to thank Andy Offit Irwin for allowing us to start the show. Andy is among the least grumpiest people that I know. So I wanted to thank him. Name for this story is Gold of the Meadow. The phrase, the gold at the end of the rainbow. Well, the gold at the end of the rainbow was searched for hundreds and hundreds of years, but nobody found it until not too long ago. Well, it was probably more than 100 years ago, but the bag of gold at the end of the rainbow was eventually found, but it was found by a stingy man, a mean, miserly guy. This man was selfish to the core. He was a cross, cranky, unpleasant, and therefore a very unhappy man. And when he found that gold, he did not want to share any of it. He decided to hide his gold, his newfound gold, deep in the earth in the middle of the woods. So one moonless night when black clouds blew across the sky and it was so dark you could barely see your hand before your face, not a star visible in the sky, that was the night the stingy man chose to bury the gold. And he lifted that big, heavy sack of gold up onto his shoulders and very quietly started off along the edge of the dark meadow where the grass grew thick and tall. In fact, this was the exact same meadow where the fairies came for their fairy dances. But the stingy man didn't know that. He only knew that the woods on the far side of the meadow was a long way from other people's houses, and not many people ever came there. Now, fairies are generally good, wise, and loving beings. They do not like selfishness. They love to do kindnesses for others, and they especially love people who are kindly and show their good hearts through their kindnesses every day for other people and fairies. But fairies are also mischievous. As that stingy, selfish man crept through the meadow to hide the gold, a fairy saw him. The fairy watched for a minute, and then she guessed that he had a stingy, miserly secret in that bag that he was trying to hide from his neighbors. And that fairy gave a small tinkling laugh and then a giggle to herself. Just a little giggle. The stingy man didn't even hear her. The wind was blowing hard, and the trees at the edge of the meadow were whispering in the wind. The stingy man was so busy creeping and sneaking that he never heard the tinkling laugh and the fairy giggle. The fairy grabbed a sharp thorn from a wild and viney rose bramble growing there in the tall grass. She leaned in toward the stingy man as he passed, and she nicked the bag of gold, pulling gently on the loose thread, and then following along behind the stingy man, making another nick, cutting a few more threads close to the first and another, until she had cut a hole in one corner of the bag with that thorn. The stingy man was so busy creeping and sneaking that he never noticed what she had done. The hole in the bag was just big enough so that one by one, the gold pieces slipped through the hole and disappeared down among the grasses. Little by little, the bag grew lighter, but the stingy man did not notice. So focused was he on reaching the woods and hiding his treasure before anyone saw him and asked him to share. Wouldn't you know, by the time he reached the wood, his bag was empty. As he looked back across the meadow, the moon peeked out from behind the dark clouds, and he saw a few glimmering bits of gold shining in the moonlight from deep in the tall grass where he had dropped them. But the laughing fairy's friends and relations had already gathered in the meadow by then. And one fairy said to another, who said to another, who said to another, who said to another, stems and leaves, that this gold may grow and put down roots and multiply by the thousands, and all who admire them may have some gold. Yes, yes, shouted the others in their small tinkling voices that sounded like the patter of rain on meadow grasses. Let the fairy gold be free alike to rich and poor. And the stingy man saw the gold pieces glimmering in the moonlight, but though he rushed to and fro trying to gather it all up, whenever he reached one of the glimmering bits, he found it had become a small golden flower on a small, sturdy green stem with little green leaves, not the hard, brittle gold pieces he remembered. All night long, the fairies worked, and all night long, the stingy man rushed from one end of the meadow to the other, searching for his lost gold pieces. When morning came, the sun rose upon the meadow, bright with gold, each piece set on a sturdy stem of its own. You may call them buttercups if you wish, laughed the mischievous fairy. But they're fairy gold now and enough for everyone.
That's lovely.
I like that story.
That's
imagining
very nice.
Giggling fairies.
I never heard that before.
I think maybe you did because I've told it before on air. But
maybe I just wasn't paying attention.
Well, I'm glad it made an impression this time.
I did, yeah. Huh. That's interesting.
That comes from digital.library.upenn.edu.
Wow. University of Pennsylvania.
Yep.
Right?
Yes.
And see, that at the beginning of that, as soon as as you started, I have a hard time with my science mind. You know, math and science are always up. But you can't find the end of the rainbow, you know?
So you were arguing with me in your head the whole time I was
talking. No, not arguing. Just That's my first thought all the time. You can't find the end of the rainbow. Nobody's ever been able to get a picture of the end of the rainbow.
Well, apparently this guy did.
I know.
Maybe he was a miserly scientist. Yeah. And he figured out a special method using mirrors and prisms and magnifying glasses.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I'm sure they could do that in Hollywood. They could come up with a picture. I always thought that was neat when I was young. I believed that there might be, you know,
gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well, yeah, you know.
Well, I did think as a child it would be worth a look.
Right. You know,
if you could get there.
But yeah, once somebody explained the rainbow to me, it took all that stuff away.
Well, what I was thinking as a child was that I would have to go to Ireland. So that would be a good excuse to go to Ireland.
Oh, boy.
Because you certainly weren't going to find the end of the rainbow.
No, I would love to go to Ireland.
Philadelphia.
And sit in a pub. Sit in a corner and sit in a pub.
Forget the gold at the end of the rainbow.
And just listen. But I figured I would have to spend probably at least a month just listening to people speak in Ireland before I would go into the pubs to hear tales. Because a person who has an Irish brogue, boy, it takes a while to understand them. For me, I think that's true of any kind of foreign language. You know, a person who speaks with, even like English. I've had a couple of students from the United Kingdom, and I can remember not understanding a word, for instance, with the Simmons boys. When their parents came for a parent conference, the father had traveled a good bit. He had been in the military, and so his accent wasn't quite as bad. But the mother never said a single sentence that I understood. She did most of the talking. And when I told Clifford, the younger brother, that I was pleased to meet his parents, but he said, "And how'd you get along with my mom?" I said, "I think fine. I never understood a word she said." He thought that was really funny for a person who was, educated and had a master's degree and all that stuff. But
well, of course, he went right home and told his mother that.
He probably did. He might have been. It wasn't disrespectful. It was just honest. I spoke to his father a number of times over the year, and I did. I told his father that, and he loved it. He roared. He said. He was very funny. This man was extremely funny. And he said, if only I could be, I think he said, doused with that. He said, there are times when I wish I didn't understand my wife at all. the way he said it was lovingly, and I could just imagine there are probably times when she was giving him what for, and he would rather not hear it. Or understand it. So, oh boy, we're just chewing up time here.
All right, but you're going to tell a story.
Yes, I have no story. Boy, this is okay. In September of 1961, in the company I was in. Stationed in Germany, Nike Ajax missiles. We had a new warrant officer assigned to our company. I don't know, people listening to this, I don't know how much people know about warrant officers. In the military, there are officers and enlisted people. Officers are starting with the rank of lieutenant, first lieutenant, going all the way up to four-star general. And then there are privates for the enlisted all the way up to master's sergeant or sergeant of the army, which is, nine steps above the beginning. But in between that, there are warrant officers, and warrant officers have a rank where they deserve the respect of an officer. They're treated as officers, but they generally do not command men or women nowadays, and they are generally technical people. Some helicopter pilots when I was in were warrant officers. Warrant Officer Brown came into our outfit in September 1961, and we had a formation, and he spoke to us. We were a Nike Ajax missile battery that defended an airbase and a hospital at Landstuhl, Germany. He introduced himself to the company. We were in ranks, and he said he was in charge of all the supplies to take care of our radars. And he said, I need a new supply clerk. I understand the supply clerk here is about to rotate back to the States. So I need a new supply clerk, and I would like you to consider this. He's talking to a large group of men. You know, we're all the radar people. There was probably about, I'm guessing there was probably 50 of us. And he said, if you can work for me, I can promise you I will give you a promotion. If it's at all possible, I'll get you a promotion by Christmas time. However, you should consider this. I am the worst SOB, and he didn't use the abbreviation. I am the worst SOB you will ever meet in your life, and I am an SOB 24 hours a day. I will not be anything but an SOB. If you work for me, you have to have a thick skin and be able to tolerate my behavior. Whew. No one raised their hand except for me. And he said, fall out of the formation and report to the office. And I did. And he interviewed me. And he said, why would you want to work for me? And I said, because I'm tired of being in the diesel generators, oil. It's disgusting. My work uniforms smell bad. It's a difficult job, and it's unpleasant because it's not what I was originally trained for. And it was a way to get a promotion, I thought. But in the military, in the Army, there are things called MOS, Military Occupational Specialty, and it's a number. You know, they're often three-digit numbers with a decimal point and another digit. And you're classified according to that. Well, I told them, my MOS is frozen. I can't get promotion. And, you know, I work hard, and I'd like to get to the next rank because that means more money. And, well, and he said, and it made sense to him. He said, okay, let's do it. And before I left, he said, remember what I said. I am not a pleasant person to work for. Well, and I thought, big deal. Well, he was not even close to being unpleasant. Wow, for some reason you disappeared from the screen, Fanny. He was grouchy, and he would find fault with the least thing. However, working for him from September to all the way up to near Christmas time, when I was going to go home on a leave. I went home on December 17th that year, and I hadn't been home since the previous summer. It had been about 16 months. He promised me if I did a good job, I would get promoted. Well, I got home to Baltimore, and in the mail, the day I got home, were my orders giving me the next step in rank. I became a specialist fourth class, and a set of
emblems to sew on my uniforms. And I was very impressed that he did that because he kept his promise. And I worked for him the rest of the time I was in the Army. When I went back in January, all the way up until July, when I finished my term of service and was going home. But the thing that was really good about Mr. Brown was he taught me how to do a job and do it well. He expected everything to be done just right. If it wasn't done just right and it was paperwork, you could be sure it would wind up in the trash can, ripped to shreds. He treated the crews that way. He expected when the operators were working on the equipment, when the maintenance men were working on equipment, he expected them to do the work to perfection. And because of him, I acquired some great habits that only a few times in my life that I let them slide. Most of the time, I have been able to use his influential teaching to do a really good job of things I set out to do. I learned how to do a really good job at whatever I set out to do, whether it was work or play. And I've always been thankful to Mr. Brown for teaching me that and for getting me the promotion and for teaching me not to expect anything for doing a good job except the satisfaction of knowing that you did a job and it was done well. So that's my story about Warrant Officer Brown.
I like it.
Good.
A perfect curmudgeon.
Oh, yes. And he was very hard to work for. But it didn't take me too long to know how to stay out of his way and get the job done, to his satisfaction, even though there were many times I had to do it over again. I labeled all the cabinets that we stored radar tubes in. There were 5,000 tubes in our trailer that powered the radars, and we constantly had tubes blow up, burn out, stuff like that. Not blow up, but burn out, like light bulbs go out, stuff. And so I was constantly ordering new ones, driving to Spangdahlem in Germany, getting an entire supply of new bulbs, cataloging them, putting them in the right drawers. The first time I labeled all the cabinets and drawers, he did not like my writing. And, I came in the next day, and that evening he had taken them all off. They were cards, like 3x5 cards, neatly lettered, I thought, and taped to the front of the cabinet. He had taken all of them off. I had scrubbed the front of the cabinets because of the sticky stuff from the tape, and I had to do them all over again. And I had to start from scratch because he tore them all up, threw them in the trash can. And if he had just thrown them on my desk, it would have been nice. But anyway, that's off Warrant Officer Brown.
Did you ever hear from him after you left Germany?
No, not at all. I wish I had. I wish I had been mature enough to seek him, to search him out, and but. He was difficult, He was and sometimes unpleasant. Not to me. He and I got along pretty well after the first couple of weeks. he liked the way I did my job, and he liked that I actually listened and did what he said. That I didn't decide to do things my way. That was one of the things he hated.
Your way is not the best way. My way is the best way.
By definition.
Yes. Right. So I think we're out of time.
Well, we are. I thought we might go another minute.
Go ahead. I think this has been a good topic.
Yeah, we should do it again sometime.
Yeah.
There are a lot of curmudgeons out there.
Right. Especially the person burying the gold wasn't one of the little people.
No.
No. But the little people are often curmudgeons.
Yes.
You know, I have a story about the little people, about my favorite leprechaun, but it's too long to do now. But we'll Patrick Aloysius Michael Sean O'Casey himself.
I remember Mr. O'Casey. You'll have to tell that another time.
Yes. All right.
All right. You've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I am one of your story hosts, Fanny Crawford.
And I'm the other one, Stacy Olkowski.
We will look forward to being with you again next Monday at 12 noon when we share stories of our community, encouraging all of our listeners to document and share and listen to each other's stories. Thanks. And coming up next,
the blues.
The blues.
That was radio manager John Gase.
Not the Blues Brothers, right? Just the blues.
Just the blues.